Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. My name is Alan Wilson, and I'm the host of the podcast. Each week, I'll be talking to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time, encouraging you to reflect on your own leadership journey. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Just look for the Leadership Journey Podcast, and while you're there, you can leave us a review. Meantime, enjoy the podcast. My guest this week, once again, is Phil Emerson, one of the senior leaders of Emmanuel Church in Lurgan. In episode one, Phil talked about his childhood and his early zeal to serve God. He talked about some of the people who influenced him and his practice of learning what he can from other leaders. Phil, welcome back. It's good to have you back on the podcast. Last week we talked about your childhood, some really interesting stories. You always make you think there's a book to be written in there somewhere, Tales of the Loch Shore or something like that.
My kids tell me that all the time. If my kids listen to this podcast, I'd be in big trouble.
Oh, really?
They've been at me to write for a long time.
So. Ah, well, there you go. I'm adding my voice to that.
I know.
Yeah.
No, they keep sending me, Dad, what life was that in?
I know. But I think there probably is a lot of appeal, among a certain generation. In relation to stories from the 60s or the 70s growing up in Northern Ireland and all that. Yeah. So we talked about that, talked about some of the influences, talked about this preaching partner that you had, Stevie Livingstone, how much he had taught you, your own mum. Talked a little bit about some of the ways that you began to sense leadership taking shape in you from God's gifting, example of your dad, and then learning along the way. And I think one of the things that was fascinating that you talked about last time was the whole idea of identifying leaders from whom you can learn and saying, you know, right, I'll come along and buy you a coffee or buy you lunch. Yeah. You imagine someone who said, that's really cheap, you know, just a coffee, you don't have to take me out to dinner. But give me an hour, I'll ask you three questions. And then and actually pulling the wisdom from people, which I think is a brilliant practical idea. Come back to your story. We need to move this on a little bit, but come back to your story. After school, did you join the family business then?
Yeah, I did. I joined the family business at 16. And worked there for about 5 years. Me and my brother, I was the youngest, as I said, but me and my brother, we made concrete blocks. Mm-hmm. And so I was there for 5 years. And then in 1980, I'd met and fallen in love with Jill. And I was married to Jill for 27 years, and she died in 06, and I'm married again. I'm married to Lorraine, and I always say, when it comes to marriage, my claim to fame is I've only went with two girls in my life and I've married them both. So there you go. So I met Jill at school. Uh-huh. and we dated from school and then went together. Jill's dad was a coal man. And he owned a little coal business in Lurgan, Billy Baxter. He was a gent, and just a good man. And he had just two daughters, no sons. And so when I was 21, I went to work with him. I left the family business, which was a bit of a biggie, you know, the first of seven kids, or first of all, there was six boys and a girl. I have a beautiful sister stuck right in the middle of the six of us, so she's in the middle, three boys, then a girl, and then three boys. So the youngest to leave the family business was a difficult time. Dad struggled with it, I know he did, and I went to work with Jill's dad, sort of co-partnered a little bit with him in the coal business, bought a vehicle, a lorry, and started a little haulage business, and worked at the haulage for a lorry driver, come coal man, so delivered a little bit of oil, did everything, and through the 80s, and then and built myself a really good business, and by late 80s, things were going really, really well. And about 89 recession hit. Back in the day when we went through the 16-70% mortgages, I'm sure you remember, Al, and we survived it. And well, almost. And the recession hit, and I had a business deal that went horribly wrong for me, sort of late 89, beginning of 90, and left me with a massive debt, over £160,000. Tried to work my way out of that, and in long story short, 2nd of August 91, the bank closed and my business failed. I was a sole trader. I owed £380,000 as a sole trader. I wasn't a limited company. And so basically lost everything, literally everything. And but, you know, my marriage was great. My kids were great. If done anything, it strengthened and did something very powerful in the midst of all that. And in the 90s then, that was 91, I went to work for Carewoods Coal in Craigavon. And I was a coal man. I carried coal, took a little franchise on there. God, just so blessed it. It was so powerful. Just to pay a lot of the debt off. That $380,000 took 13 years to pay. And it wasn't, it didn't go bankrupt, but became a, what they called an arranging debtor. Had to make an arrangement with my creditors and all of that. So it was a horrible time.
Can I ask you, I mean, you mentioned your family and the strength of family and so on through that. What about your faith in that kind of a catastrophe, really, a business catastrophe that befell you? Was that affected in one way or another?
No, Alan, it never was. It never... It's kind of weird looking back, but it never was. There was never a doubt. There was never a... Like, I remember lying on the floor, beating my fists off the ground and crying out to God, but I never once ever doubted Him. Never once ever thought, you know... I'm sure there are moments where I thought, how could you ever let this happen? But I never doubted His existence or the fact that he would turn it in some shape or form and bring beauty out of ashes and all of that. So, so no, never really affected my faith, you know. And even through those 91 through to 95 were weird years, you know, because carrying coal in Craigavon was a learning curve, like, you know.
Why is that?
Well, it was like, it was in first name terms with the local police in the station, you know. It was like in it every weekend. They stole coal off the lorry. I got held up. I got robbed. I got beat up a couple of times. It was great fun, but it was a big learning curve. But God broke my heart for the city. That's where it was in those years that God broke my heart for. For Lurgan, Portadown, Craigavon.
I wanted to ask. Was there anything that came out of that difficult circumstance? But tell us more about how that happened.
Well, I was a brethren boy, and all of a sudden, I was face to face with people who, you know, I had customers who couldn't afford a bag of coal, that I had to do all kinds of things that, you know, didn't have doors, seats or tables, chairs in their home because they'd cut them all up for firewood, you know, because anything to get money for drink and drugs. And I began to minister to these people in the coal run. And when I say minister, it wasn't like it was just my second nature, really. Maybe it was my first nature. It was just that I wanted to see something happen in their lives. And then in 1995, in the midst of all that, and I was still trying to pay the debt off. I was working through this coal run. I had a really bad fire. We lost a house in the fire. So it was like it felt like a stripping. Felt like God was bringing me through and it's kind of weird, actually, when I think back on it, because you sort of think, when I tell the story, you think it was like the devil. And I never actually blamed the devil. All, you know, I never felt God desert me or leave me. I always felt that God was in the midst of it all and through the hardships. And so 95 we lost the fire, we lost our home in the fire, and I lost my car, and I lost my, because where we lived was in a little bit of a slant. The oil tank melted at the back of the house with this fire. The oil ran down, burnt my car, and burnt, I had one vehicle, one lorry that I used, and I lost it. I lost everything. Lost totally everything in the fire. And my big, I had a big Labrador dog and two cats there. I lost them in the fire as well. And it was like, I remember the morning after the fire, sitting thinking, God, what do you want from me? Well, it feels like everything's been stripped away. And, you know, tell me what you want, because I'll give it to you. You know, if you tell me what you want, I'll give it to you. I don't ever remember getting an answer at that particular time. And then we rebuilt the home. Our home was, the structure was okay, so it was all internal, and we rebuilt. And the room, one of the rooms that we rebuilt, was the room I planted the church in.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was these people in the coal run, you know, began to really see God was doing something in our community. Didn't really know what to do with them. And as I said, Jill was alive at the time, and she was a powerful visionary, you know. I always said she was the accelerator and I was the brake, you know. and she said, Phil, why don't we do something in the house? Why don't we just bring them home?
Mm-hmm.
And so with a couple of other people that were great friends at the time, we planted Emmanuel. And called Emmanuel back then. We didn't really know what to call it, but we knew we needed to do something. And hence, 8th of September 1996 was our first Sunday morning service, mm-hmm. with a mm-hmm. few of us in our living room.
So had you been still part of Ardmore Gospel Hall up to this point?
No. About 92, I went to a little church, a little charismatic church in 91 after my business failed. I thought I carried a bit of shame.
Mm.
I felt from the Brethren movement, and this was nothing to do with the Brethren movement. This was totally, I'm owning this, you know. I felt I was bringing a bit of embarrassment and shame on them that my business had failed, and a lot of them were businessmen and businesswomen, and my business had failed, and I felt ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt I was carrying shame on them, and I started to really search. My kids were hitting teens. I couldn't really get them to go. There was nothing really for them, and I didn't, you know, and so we started to look around. Went to a little charismatic church called Lurgan Bible Church, which lasted a few years in the early 90s, and that was my sort of introduction to charismatic things. And I remember thinking, you know, my theology didn't agree with a lot of what was going on. But again, I was catching something.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no education at all. I came out of school at 15 to work a concrete mixer for my dad. And the last year of school didn't really attend very much. And so I have no education as such. But so a lot of my stuff's caught more than taught. And so again, something started to catch in me that either some of these people, and you know, we've had the extremes, you know, and we've seen the extremes, and both of us, I'm sure, we've seen the extremes of both sides, you know, but I felt like God was calling me to investigate more of Him, for want of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
And
what happened?
I was standing on top of a powder tank. I was hauling. I was working as a coal man. I was doing a bit of lorry driving for another company at the same time to try and earn money to pay the debt off. And I was standing in the middle of a big powder shed, the powder that they make PVC pipes with. I hauled that for the PVC group in Doncaster. And I was standing on the top of a tank. at 6 o'clock one morning and I had an encounter with God. I nearly fell off the top of the tank. But I had an encounter with God, and I was age 33. And I realized for the first time in my life, I was saved when I was 6. And I realized at 33 that God loved me. It was the first time I knew he loved me. And it was like, people talk about baptism. I had a baptism of God's love. I always thought that God was just like the angry father who tolerated me and loved me but didn't really like me and who sort of put up with me. And I don't know what it was. I wasn't reading my Bible. I was praying. It took about 40 minutes to fill the tank, and I was just standing waiting for the silly thing to fill. And something happened, and it was like a baptism of the love of God, and it broke me. And I wept and wept and wept, and it went on for days. I just, every time I get emotional actually when I think of it now, all these years down the line, you know, it was just like, and it changed my life forever. I saw God through a different lens. I saw God that just totally, absolutely loved me and wanted to be with me more than I actually wanted to be with him. And that revolutionized my life. And if I had fervor for him before, you know, it's when you're working for somebody that you feel is your master, and all of a sudden you change to working for somebody who you feel is your dad. It changes things, doesn't it?
So this wasn't something that you'd been seeking or someone had said you need to experience this?
Not really. It was just a total, call it what you may, baptism in the Holy Spirit, baptism of love. I don't know a name for it. But it was certainly an experience that changed my life forever, you know. And it was beautiful. It was really, really beautiful. And so, 96 then, I from 96 through to 2001, through the early first 6 years of Emmanuel, I worked. After the fire, because I'd lost all my web, I went back to work with my brothers again. And I went back and I sailed a sand barge in Loch Ness, which I still do a little bit to this day.
Do you really?
Yeah. Now and again, not much, but if any of their guys are on holidays, I have a pilot's license for sailing. Hey, so
okay.
So
sailing a sandbox in Loch Ness. Yeah.
So I love it, and I worked as a sailor and it was a brilliant job because it was in the early days of church planting. I was 13 hours a day on my own. So it was totally solitude. It was on my own in a sand barge in the middle of Loch Ness every day. So it was just a season of life. It just seemed that God prepared all these seasons for me. And I worked at that right through to 2001. Church, we had maybe about 100 people in it.
So the church then began to develop. Just you're inviting these people that you'd met to your home.
Yeah.
What did church look like?
It was weird. Alan, it's kind of funny because, you know, the first morning, you know, there was literally a dozen of us in the room, and 6 of them were my family, you know. And we went to break bread, you know, and the weeks that preceded that, some guys would come and you know, They didn't know what breaking a bread was no more than, you know, anything. So when we went to remember the Lord, they would go out and roll a joint on the windowsill, the front windowsill of my home. I remember thinking, God, what are we doing? This seems weird. But it seemed weird enough to be God, you know. Thankfully, a lot of them are still with us, and they're not rolling joints anymore. Which you'd be glad to know.
We didn't incorporate that into some kind of liturgy. No.
We brought them on from that, thank God. So, but it's been beautiful actually. To, you know, I remember Christmas time in '96. Christmas, you know, after 3 months of doing this, I remember Jill and I on our knees at the side of bed one night, and I remember we prayed this sincerely, tearfully, and then we actually started to laugh when we prayed it. We prayed, God, would you please just send us some normal people? And then we laughed about that for years to come, you know, just send us some normal people.
And did he?
We found out that those actually were quite normal people.
Right, okay. It was just a redefinition of normal.
It was a redefinition of normal, and we learned very soon in this job that everybody's got issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just some of us are better at hiding them.
Yeah. Right.
Some of us have got more educated in how to hide them. So so that was a...
So that was that grew to about 100 within the first 5 years. And you weren't still meeting in your house at this point.
No, we were a year and a half in the house. And then we got a Phyllis and Hertford Arnold offered us a little building out in Donaghcloney on their farm. Mm-hmm. And we moved out there. They were so good to us. They're the most beautiful people. And they were so good to us in every way. And that was our home for 3 years till we outgrew it, you know. It was beautiful. And it was out in the sticks, really. And God had given us a bit of a prophetic word at the time, that, you know, because it was almost, again, it was up a big long lane. And you sort of thought nobody would ever come in here. Then God had given us a word that, you know, a bit like Moses been hid in the bulrushes, you know, how do you hide a baby for 3 months without a little bit of divine intervention? Mm-hmm. You know, and it felt like God had taken us somewhere to hide us, you know, more to, maybe not to build numerically, but to put roots down. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened, you know, that we spent some years out there, and it was a beautiful time.
And then did you move back into Lurgan?
And then we bought our very first building in Union Street. And
is that where the Gospel Hall used to be?
Oh God, that was it. We bought the old Gospel Hall.
Right, okay.
And we bought the old Gospel Hall, and it was quite an interesting thing, because the three things that we felt God put in our hearts from the early days was family, army, and hospital. Mm-hmm. I felt that we would do those were our three, may still are, that we're called to be a family, we're called to be a hospital, and we're called to be an army, a family and mission, obviously. And so when we moved to Lurgan, the army came into being, and we just saw phenomenal growth. Within a year, we doubled. We went from 100 to 200 within about 10 months.
Can you describe how that happened? Was there a lot of evangelism going on?
We did a door-to-door survey.
Yeah.
And because Union Street... excuse me, because Union Street was a difficult little street to park in, some of the neighbours were concerned that this was going to be a church, and so we thought we'd do a door-to-door survey, and Jill and I decided we would do the immediate locality and talk to the neighbours and pastorally get them on board, and just some of the people that we met that are still part of our church through that. My brother, who again was a great part of our team and still is, he bumped into some people. It was a bit like, the only way I can describe it is some of the people that we saw saved there were almost like domino effect. Strategic paramilitary, big paramilitary figures who got saved. People who had just colourful backgrounds, who it seemed like one would get saved and 10 of their mates would say, what's this all about? I'm going to see what's happened, Joe. And they would come, and all 10 of them would just, it was as quick as that. It was just like every week we were just seeing people saved. Every week, every time we would meet, people were being saved.
Were you deliberately preaching evangelistically, or what was going on?
No, that wasn't. It was nothing to do with us at all. It was just like all we seemed to be doing was opening the doors, and people were coming, and we were praying, and we were preaching the word, and it just seemed to be like this onslaught of salvation. And within 10 months, we're buying our first building without growing it. So I remember sitting 10 months after we'd opened the door saying, we've got a problem. Good problem as it might be, it's a problem still to see.
Yeah.
And we can stay or we can go. So we began to look again. Mm-hmm. And that was back in the days of dial-up internet. When you had to dial up. And I remember one Sunday night coming home and my wife saying to me, Phil, we dialed up and we found the old Super Value building in Castle Lane mm-hmm. was for sale. And they were looking $1.5 million for it. Mm-hmm. Been up for sale for a long time. So I'm sounding a bit like Adam here, you know, where he blamed his wife, you know. So Jill talked me into...
Well, you did say earlier on you're a risk taker.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. There's no doubt.
Because she talked to you in.
She talked me into it. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so we rang Lisney. Mm-hmm. And they said it was for sale, looking at $1.5 million. And she was at the other side of the table, said, put a bid on. You know, this sort of, you know... And, you know, this conversation telling you what to say. And So I said to the guy on the phone, how do I go about putting a bid in that? He said, just tell me now what you would like to put on. And I said, and she goes, $500,000. So I says to the guy, this is coming from some, we didn't have 2D, we had no money at all. I hadn't been. And I said to the guy, well, what if we were to offer $500,000? And he said, well, go and put it to Super Value and see. And, so he went and he off the phone, and I thought that was the end of it, you know, done and dusted. I'd done my bit, I'd made the call. He phoned me within 2 hours, Alan, and he said, is that Mr. Emerson? I said, it is. And he goes, I've spoke to Super Value and they've accepted your bid. And I always say my next response wasn't godly. You know, I didn't know what.
Because now you're going to have to find $500,000.
So I was like, oh my word, what are we going to do? What in the wide world? So, but long story short, I could talk to you for hours about how God provided for that. It was supernaturally powerful. Mm. It was just little principles that God taught us around finance and then around losing our business. Mm-hmm. And I should say, you know, going back to losing my business, God taught me the principle of tithing. Hmm. And we learned that you could never outgive God. Mm-hmm. And so we learned that principle, and it's a principle that we've kept to this day mm-hmm. strong. That is the beginning of our giving. Mm-hmm. You know, that we dare not give, I would say we dare not give less, you know. And so there's something about in that principle. God began to teach us about that. So the story of that building we're in now is, I could tell you story after story around the finances of God's provision. That is just...
Tell us one.
Well, one of the earliest ones was we knew that we were going to have to do something around the building, and so we decided that we would put together a little building fund. There'd be £10,000 in the building fund. Mm-hmm. And one of our elders at that time, there was only three of us in eldership, and one of the elders, at that particular time, we were supporting a church in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And he had went out with a couple of other guys to see the work there. It was back in the day when the container ministries were the big thing. I know they're still going, but back then they were big. You know, it was back in the sort of... you know, in around the 90s. And so it was big. And so he had went out and he rang me from Ukraine and he said to me, Phil, we're sending stuff out here in containers. They've actually nowhere to store it, but we've found a big store. It's an old airplane hangar, disused one. And he says, we can buy it for whatever the Ukraine, you know, monetary system was. And he said, how much is that? And he goes, it's £10,000. And he says, I know you have £10,000 in that wee building fund account. Could we borrow that, he said, for this building? And he said, when we get home, we'll talk to some businessmen and we'd refurbish your account, give you that £10,000. I said, hey, you know, it's not my money, it's God's money. Of course you can. So we sent the money, the £10,000, to Ukraine. Totally emptied the account. And the following Tuesday night, they were home and we were in a prayer meeting and we were on our knees. There was about 20 of us and we were in a circle on our knees. And on my knees, you know, that unction, when you know when God speaks, you know, it's not that it's audible, but you know the way you fight it. Is that me? Is that God? And I had an old mentor who used to say to me, the first thought's usually God and the second one's usually your own. You know, so we can say, you know, go and encourage Alan. And then eventually what we do, no one's going to think I'm silly. Mm-hmm. And we rob God's thought. So the first thought was, I felt God said to me, you shouldn't have lent that money. And so this argument, I was on my knees and I said, well, what do you want me to do with it? You should give it. You don't lend it, you give it. And so the two guys I'd given the money, lent the money to, were in the prayer meeting and they were on their knees and there just happened to be an empty seat between them. Mm-hmm. So I, on my knees, crawled across this room, sort of up in between these two guys in the middle of the prayer meeting, and in whispered tones while somebody else is praying, I know this is highly irreverent, I said to the guys, listen, I shouldn't have lent you the money. They took the wrong connotation. They thought I was looking the money back. So they said, no, we're going to give the money back. And I said, no, you're not listening to me. I shouldn't have lent it. I should have given it. No. So I said, no, we're not taking it back. The money's it's gone. It's yours. Forget about it. So it was one of those ones, you know, and it went back to my seat and then thought, how am I going to explain this to the elders, you know? But they were fine. That was on a Tuesday night, Alan. On Friday night, I came home from work and I was sitting at my tea and there was a knock at the door. One of my kids came in and said, there's a man at the door looking at you, Dad. And I went out, a businessman. He didn't come to our church or anything. And he just said to me, look, I don't know what this is all about, but he said, I felt God speak to me about this today. And he gave me a white envelope, walked back, got into his car. I came in and opened the envelope. There was £10,000. Tuesday to Friday.
Yeah.
And that's one of the stories.
That's amazing. Does that mean then the tithing thing, which is a strong principle for you, and presumably you teach it in the church, is generosity a big part of what you've tried to build into it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's one of our strong values.
Uh-huh.
So we say sometimes whenever I meet with church leaders and my fathering role, I'll say to them, you know, have you got values?
Mm-hmm.
And they always come back, oh, so of course we've got values. And I say, well, what are they?
Mm-hmm.
And very seldom can they tell me because people assume their values.
Yeah, they do. Uh-huh.
And so I say values will set a culture, mm-hmm. but the opposite is also true.
Mm-hmm.
Culture sets values.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we don't, so generosity is one of our
mm-hmm.
values. And so we create a culture
mm-hmm.
of generosity, mm-hmm. which is really important to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, I mean, I suppose it's like Paul in 2 Corinthians, you know, talking about, you said earlier on, you can't outgive God.
No.
And I guess God looks for that generosity, but he's able to keep on giving even more than...
Totally.
And any of us give. You've totally. Proved that in the life of the church. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Listen, we're probably needing to stop there. So we'll come back one more time.
Okay.
If that's all right.
Yeah.
And there's still a few things that I want to talk maybe about, some of the turning points, some okay. of the challenges of leadership, and maybe some of the things that you'd want to share with younger leaders. I know you meet a lot with younger leaders, but maybe some of the things that you'd want to share on the podcast. So we'll come back and we'll talk some more about it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bless you.
Thanks, Phil. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Leadership Journey podcast. Phil will be back again next week. We'll be exploring some more of his story. He'll be talking about an experience of deep personal loss, and he'll also be sharing the three top things that he'd say to a young leader. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. That will allow you to receive the podcast episode automatically. If you follow me on Twitter at JS Alan Wilson, you can watch for the link when the podcast goes live next week. In the meantime, have a good week and God bless you.